Welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. So we've got the usual two interviews up. First, in a few minutes, we'll be talking with Preston Smith, who teaches at Mount Holyoke College, about his notion of racial democracy versus social democracy, which is he developed this in studies of 1940 Chicago, but seems very relevant to the study of another phenomenon, Chicago-related phenomenon, the election of Barack Obama as President of the United States and all the celebrations around that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Anthony DaCosta, who's an economist who specializes in India, a professor at the Copenhagen Business School and in their Indian Studies program. And we'll talk to him first about the horrendous events in Mumbai, the terrorist massacre there, and then more broadly about the situation of Muslims and other ethnic minorities in India. And Indian neoliberalism. We've heard a lot about how India is shining these days. That's the preferred phrase of the promoters of the Indian neoliberal way. We'll ask Anthony just how much of India is shining and how brightly, and will it continue to do so in the coming months and years? Okay, and now some words in the news before we move on. Economies continue to deteriorate at home and abroad. I often cite the surveys done by the Institute for Supply Management, or ISM, the Trade Association for Purchasing Managers, the people who buy things for large corporations. Their jobs put them in close contact with the state of business, and the state of business is not good. The ISM surveys of both manufacturing companies and service companies, both released over the last week, were very ugly and are consistent with a deep recession. And speaking of recession, as you've probably heard, it's now official. The arbiter of these things, the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research, declared earlier this week that the expansion that was born in late 2001 died last December, age six, of old age and stagnation. Yes, it took them a year to make up their minds, about twice as long as they usually take. Hey guys, I had it figured out in February when the January employment report was released, but I'm not a high-paid, prestigious economist, so who's listening to me? For the first 6 or 8 months of the recession, that is, through August or September of this year, it looked pretty mild. There were job losses, but not as bad as the job losses we've seen in earlier downturns. Other economic indicators headed south, along with the job market, but most not so sharply. But over the last few months, there's been an acceleration to the downside. Job losses are now averaging close to 300,000 a month, the neighborhood that's characteristic of recessions, and we may see that many Friday morning when the November report on employment is released. But I've been reviewing some of the major economic indicators, including the ones the Business Cycle Daters, a group whose name almost cries out for a joke, including some of the ones they look at, and several things stand out about that review. While the declines in employment, household incomes, and business investment aren't out of line with historical averages, their growth going into last December's cyclical peak was a lot weaker than those averages have been in the past. In fact, the expansion, which lasted a month longer than 6 years, was the weakest by a considerable margin of any of the 10 we've had since 1948, whether you measure by the economist's favorite indicator, GDP growth, or by a more humanly relevant indicator like employment growth. GDP growth was a third below historical expansion averages, employment growth two-thirds below. This suggests to me that there are some real structural problems with the U.S. economy, like low levels of real investment, excessive reliance on borrowed money, and a malignantly lopsided distribution of income. These are now undermining the performance of the economy even by the most conventional measures. All this suggests that this recession could be long and deep, and as for length, it's already a month longer than the post-World War II average downturn. It need only extend into May, which now seems quite likely, to become the longest since the 1929 to 33 downturn, or collapse, or whatever you want to call it. end up my review of how these indicators behave around business cycle peaks and early recession periods. This is the time when the economy would normally be stabilizing and beginning to turn up. None of these indicators, none of the leading indicators which presage what these indicators are going to do, none of these are suggesting that any kind of turn of that sort is anywhere close. So it looks like we are going to set a record for the length of this recession. Of course, with central banks cutting interest rates and printing lots of money, and with governments around the world plotting huge stimulus spending programs, they can probably avoid the worst outcome, that is Great Depression II. But I'm still guessing that 2009 will be pretty ugly. And here's an update added just for the KPFA audience. That commentary was recorded on Thursday evening before the release of the November employment report on Friday morning. Now we have it, and it was horrid from top to bottom. About the only bright spot you can find in it was a small drop in the teen unemployment rate, though it's still over 20%. That's it. Almost everything else in it was dismal. Employers shed 533,000 jobs in November. Worse, initial estimates of the job losses in September and October were increased by almost 200,000, bringing the three-month total job loss to 1.3 million. While these aren't the worst in history, they're still very, very bad. The losses were widely distributed across economic sectors. Construction and manufacturing got hit very hard, losing over 160,000 between them. And it wasn't just about houses and cars. Non-residential construction actually lost more jobs than residential, and almost every line of factory work was down. About the only sectors adding jobs were state and local government and that perennial health care. And given the fiscal pressures facing the public sector, expect government to start shrinking soon. Taking a longer-term perspective, while losses so far since the December 2007 business cycle peak are slightly less than recession averages, most previous recessions were drawing to a close a year after their peaks. Not this time. Those numbers all come from a survey of employers. The Bureau of Labor Statistics also does a monthly survey of households, and its findings were equally dismal. The unemployment rate rose 0.2 points to 6.7%, the highest level in 15 years, and almost all the rise was the result of permanent job loss, as opposed to temporary layoffs or new entrants. The rise over the last months isn't record-setting, but it is still very large. The so-called employment population ratio, the share of the adult population working, fell by 0.4 points to 61.4%, its lowest level in 15 years. The employment boom of the late 1990s has been largely undone over the last year. While it's a common practice in Europe to cite the number of unemployed rather than a percentage as a headline indicator, we don't do that often in the United States. But it is worth pointing out that the ranks of the officially jobless crossed 10 million in October and rose by another 250,000 in November. More than 5 million are now classed as not in the labor force but still wanting a job now. You can't be officially unemployed unless you're looking actively for work. If you've given up, the search is hopeless. You're not counted as unemployed. The broadest measure of unemployment, the U6 rate, which includes both these sets of would-be workers, along with people who want full-time work but can only find part-time, rose to 12.5%. That's the highest level since the Bureau of Labor Statistics began reporting the number in 1994. As bad as this report is, it's still bad recession and not total collapse, though who's to say what December and January may bring. The need for a very large fiscal stimulus now looks undebatable, even on very orthodox terms. Okay, back to the previously scheduled programming. Barack Obama's cabinet choices are getting high praise from all the centrist and right-wing pundits, while his liberal cheerleaders are searching for nice things to say. But let's leave aside for a moment the residence of his cabinet nominees in the political spectrum. Let's just talk for a moment about their alleged experience. Could someone tell me what foreign policy experience Hillary Clinton has? She lived with a president for 8 years, though probably on many occasions they slept in separate bedrooms. But why is she greeted as such an experienced hand? And more criticisms of the big economic guys are in order as well. Tim Geithner, the Treasury nominee, reportedly wants to get rid of Sheila Bair as head of the FDIC. By most accounts, Bair has done an admirable job in saving some banks on conditions favorable to the government and to homeowners. But Geithner thinks she's not a team player. More likely is that he sees her as a potential rival for prestige and power. If he prevails in getting rid of Bair, this will be a signal that not only will the new gang be a political disappointment, they might be lacking in competence as well. And then there's the eminence grise Robert Rubin, whom I kicked about last week for having resisted regulation of derivatives when he was Clinton's Treasury Secretary and for having helped drive Citigroup into the ground during his term as a senior counselor at the bank. Last weekend, Rubin was quoted in the Wall Street Journal as having said that no one could have foreseen this crisis. In fact, many people did, including some of his colleagues in the Clinton administration. And no one should be held accountable for the failure. Asked by the Wall Street Journal reporter if he had any regrets, Rubin said, "I guess I don't think of it quite that way. I think we've got a new theme song for the new administration."
Ni le bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien, non, je ne regrette rien, c'est payé.
That wasn't Robert Rubin singing, that was Edith Piaf singing, Non, je regrette rien, I regret nothing, and I apologize for my horrendous French. We are now joined by Preston Smith, who teaches politics at Mount Holyoke College. Welcome to Behind the News, Preston Smith.
Thanks, Doug. It's good to be back on the show.
I think it's been about 10 years since you were here last, but we'll still call it a return engagement.
It's been a while, yes.
I was reading a draft column that Adolf Reed put together for the next issue of the Progressive magazine, and he cited you as saying that the reception of Barack Obama's election marks a triumph of what you call racial democracy over social democracy. So rather than asking Adolf, who gets plenty of airtime on this show, what he meant by that, I thought I'd ask you what you meant by that. Tell us about the distinction between racial and social democracy.
Well, racial democracy has to do with democratization of social institutions, American institutions along racial lines. So really eliminating all the racial obstacles to getting access. In fact, my research has to do with housing policy, so I focus on particularly the obstacles to housing markets and even housing policy. So the idea would be that an individual qualified black individual would be able to buy their own home and live in any neighborhood they want to without obstacles like discrimination and segregation. So very much has geared towards eliminating those obstacles. Social democracy is really more focused on reducing class inequality and housing. And so it focuses on the ability to get adequate housing regardless of your income. Racial democracy means if you have the income, you should have access to good housing and access in any neighborhood. Social democracy along housing lines would have to do with the fact that you should get adequate income no matter what your income is.
So how does this relate to Barack Obama and his incoming administration?
Well, it has to do with, during the period that I look at, which is 1940 to 1960, I look at a group of civic and policy elites, black civic and policy elites based in Chicago, and they also had ties to policy elites in New York and Washington, D.C., particularly a set of black professionals working for federal housing agencies as race relations. And so what you see is coming out of the 1930s is more social democratic elements in their thinking and their plans, particularly a more robust kind of public housing as opposed to looking at private housing or even redevelopment. This is in the early 40s, right after the World War II. But as time progresses, particularly into the late 40s and 50s, they begin to shift their focus onto private housing, particularly the neglected black middle-class housing market. And so more of their focus began to look at racial obstacles than broad sort of obstacles that all working people were focusing on. And part of this had to do, of course, with the external political environment, which was, you know, heavy anti-communism and really sort of any critical look at redistributive agenda. But they also had internal reasons in terms of the way in which they looked at housing as a way to reproduce their particular class interests. And so this was going on, and I call this period a sort of quest for racial democracy. I think what we're having now with the Obama administration is the fulfillment of that dream, the fulfillment of racial democracy, the fulfillment of a black middle class dream of racial parity, basically, that the idea that you would have a proportion of blacks in at every class level, not really at all subvert or undermine the class structure. The idea was basically to have the same number, same proportion of blacks in the upper class, middle class, and poor as you would have whites, and I think that sort of ideal is now in case in the Obama election, and I think we'll see it in the Obama administration.
Let's talk a bit about your studies of 1940 Chicago, which we see a lot of this developing in its early stages.
Mm-hmm.
You've got an article you sent me with three case studies. There's I forget the name of the plan to build housing.
West Chesterfield?
Yes.
Yeah, that's actually a good case study because in showing this shift, West Chesterfield was a plan by the Chicago Housing Authority to build 125 duplexes in the far south side of Chicago near sort of Lilydale, and West Chesterfield was considered to be actually the most affluent black enclave, not only in Chicago but nationally. So CHA wanted to build war housing, which were for black war workers who were working in the steel mills and other production facilities.
And did they choose that because they thought it was a black neighborhood already? Or?
Well, yes. I mean, I think certainly there was restrictive covenants. There was the idea that you couldn't build, so it was certainly easier to do that. And so, you know, the affluent black homeowners had a legitimate gripe and say that, you know, why build it here if you won't build this in a white neighborhood? But that wasn't the opposition took the form of, you know, because these are duplexes. We're not talking about the Robert Taylor Homes or Stateway Gardens, which are these high rises. We're talking about duplexes that were going to revert to the private housing market. So very different kind of public housing, but they still opposed it on the same grounds that it would threaten property values, their property values, and also introduce an element of social disorganization. Basically, that the black workers would bring behavioral pathologies to the neighborhood. And so this was the opposition. There was amongst some black civic elites and labor leaders criticized these affluent black homeowners who were led by a black dentist. And they, you know, could criticize and saw for what it was, class bigotry. But they also used racial democratic sort of language or discourse to criticize this move. And what they did was, you know, they said that if you endorse this kind of class discrimination, we would lose the moral high ground when we, in fact, oppose restrictive covenants. So that was one way. So it was an appeal to kind of racial unity to fight and not to have any kind of class stratification or class conflict going on. But eventually the black homeowners changed their tune and said, well, it's not that we're against the war workers, we're against the CHA because we don't believe they'll build the same quality of public housing in this black neighborhood as you would in a white neighborhood. So the issue shifted from, in a sense, kind of a class attack, if you will, on black workers and what they would bring to the neighborhood to racism on the part of CHA. So it was a way in which racial democracy or the language of racial democracy, and it also neutralized black labor leaders who said, oh, yeah, we're also in favor of these people getting better homes, too. It neutralized a class critique or class elements by using racial democracy. And so I think that there was a real lesson here that sometimes social democracy or the move to social democracy can be absorbed and deflected by racial democratic discourse.
You also say that this the notion of racial democracy tends to conceive of black people as a single unitary thing distinctions, right?
Right.
Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, it's the idea is to see it as a collective racial entity, a racial collectivity, and with that, it mutes any kind of intra-racial stratification, plus particularly on class lines, but also on gender lines and also could be region as well. And so part of the quest and the dream for these elites, which I think is borne fruit, I guess, in the last 4 years, but certainly not to the height that we have right now, is that they would lead the racial group into racial group progress. But again, it would be in such a way that they, as elites and this sort of closer class, would benefit most, because the critique was, you know, largely, again, let's get rid of the obstacles that are blocking sort of worthy and people who are prepared to move into American institutions, and therefore, sort of filter through. And so for working class and poor blacks, they didn't have the access through this particular model to be able to see their life chances or their opportunities increase. They could only benefit vicariously by what benefits they were sort of accruing at the upper status level.
I'm speaking with Preston Smith, who teaches at Mount Holyoke College, and you also a couple of other examples. Occupancy standards, that sounds like one of those high-minded civic improvement things. What was the angle on that?
Well, this is Robert Weaver's idea, and Robert Weaver, you know, was the heavyweight here in terms of race and housing during a particular time. And, you know, his sort of well-meaning, I think, attempt to isolate, standards that had to do with racism. We were talking about restrictive racial covenants were still prevalent until 1940, actually beyond that too. You know, the 1948 Supreme Court decision made them unenforceable, but they still existed beyond that time. And so his idea was that let's make race-neutral, or let's institute race-neutral occupancy standards so we could see that the kinds of controls that are put on housing and occupancy and residency would not be race-based. But, of course, they would be, in fact, by default, class-based, because there was nothing to criticize something like, for instance, lot size, you know, in terms of the suburbs or even part of outlying neighborhoods, which would require a certain level of income to be able to live in that particular neighborhood. And it also, you know, so the occupancy standards, they privilege income, and they also privilege cultural capital, which had to do with middle-class socialization. So here was an attempt to challenge or oppose a racial discrimination with a plan that was race neutral, but in fact would leave intact the already class bias of private housing markets and homeowner associations.
And then finally, the carry ordinance. What was that all about?
Well, the carry ordinance had to do with trying to make publicly aided housing. This was housing that was supported by the federal government for redevelopment. And so the big issue here was Legg Meadows, which was the first major redevelopment project, housing project, for an affluent professional class around the Loop, actually, around the Loop and the Lake. And so the carry ordinance was, again, focusing on racial discrimination. And again, these things are important, and you know, you understand basically, you know, because Chicago has, you know, led the nation, if you will, and reinforcing and entrenching racial segregation. So it's not the question of whether these things were important. It's just that, almost ironically, because they were so entrenched, any other focus on other ideas or other outcomes, social democrat outcomes, got pushed to the wayside. So it dealt with racial discrimination, and it dealt with the issue of what people were thinking about in terms of Negro clearance, which is that you move the residents out of, you know, it's also urban renewal, you move the residents out of their homes, you declare them as slums, And then you replace them, people fought, by you replace them by white downtown workers because it was close to the Loop, a nice location. That was the thinking. But in this particular case, the primary occupants and primary residents of Lake Meadows were actually black professionals, the black middle class. So you had a language that dealt with Negro clearance, and you had a tool like the carry ordinance to deal with racial discrimination. But it didn't go far enough or couldn't go far enough to actually protect lower-income tenants or even, you know, some of the moderate-income homeowners to protect their housing. And, in fact, another segment of the black population, in this case a segment of the black middle class, benefited from this housing. So you needed a different language or and different tools to be able to fight something like that.
What kind of language would that be?
Well, I think a social democratic language. I mean, the vision that was coming out of the 1930s, particularly with the Labor Housing Conference in the 1930s, was to not see public housing as a reserve for the poor, or even the working poor as some sort of transitional program. This conference not only opposed public housing, but also opposed slum clearance and urban redevelopment as land grabs and giveaways to real estate developers. They had in mind that you would, in fact, make subsidies available to a broad range of working class people and even, lower middle class or moderate income people. And these would be subsidies both for buying homes but also rental housing. And they had the forethought. It was led by Catherine Bauer, who was a housing activist at the time, and she had the forethought to think that really the only political force that could be able to do this would be organized labor. Well, it didn't. It sort of petered out by the 1940s, but in that social democratic vision, that broad division got sort of eliminated or limited to public housing. The lack of vision is certainly not entirely the fault of black civic and policy elites. But they also, through their own interests, endorsed a different orientation away from social democracy into something that was more compatible with racial democracy. In other words, in the 1950s, they began to embrace the idea of free enterprise and private housing industry being the primary provider of housing. And what that did was, they tried to focus on the fact of free markets, to say the fact, there are worthy and qualified black individuals who are not free to choose. And so that, again, sort of unintendedly, perhaps, endorsed, private housing instead of a more interventionist role for government.
Well, it would make sense at some level for these black elites to embrace class society since they're its beneficiaries. Why would they want to talk in more universal social democratic terms?
Well, I think because, for a couple of reasons. I think coming out of the 30s and 40s, the large number of black people are working class. So if they had any claims for speaking for the black community, they had to at least play symbolic obedience to social democratic policies. Some of them, I think were also sympathetic to wanting to put into practice more social democratic elements. But I think it was largely for the fact that they knew that their population would not take them seriously unless they paid obedience to these ideals. In order to have a sort of political legitimacy. So I think what has happened is that, that language got transmuted into racial democracy and a very class racial democracy. So there's always been a sort of rhetorical an endorsement of these goals. But when it comes down to actual policy and endorsing policy, they end up being much more narrow, much more limited. And not surprising, something that is benefits their class.
No, just speaking in purely demographic terms, black voters have historically been one of probably the most solid bedrock of social democratic support in American politics. And now with Obama about to take office and looking like he's going to be anything but a social democrat in his governing style, what will this do to the black portion of the population is kind of the avant-garde or the bedrock or the foundation of a social democratic politics?
Well, I think that I think they'll be disappointed. I think that there's a lot of expectations. They'll be continuing used to looking at symbolic racial benefits by appointments. I think Obama will continue to do that. I mean, just by the, you know, will use himself in his election as an indication of racial progress. Of course, I think, you know, black voters are too sophisticated for that. So I think that they will, you know, as black voters have been tired of many black mayors who've not been able to deliver when it comes to, you know, their needs, their sort of political, social and economic needs. I don't know. I think they'll be, you know, disillusioned. I hope that it would usher in a sort of more stringent critique, even though they've been the bedrock of social democracy in the U.S. I think it's still been whittled down and limited over the years, and so there might be, in fact, a possibility to reinvigorate, I think, a real sense of social democracy and a real redistributive agenda. And I think hopefully some of the distraction, I think, that sometimes race can play will be pushed aside with, I think, what would be more of a centrist and perhaps even regressive agenda of Obama.
And finally, just a moment, but Edel said, I think, that, you know, that Valerie Jarrett, the intimate advisor of Barack Obama, is a descendant of Robert Taylor, he for whom the houses were named. What was that relation all about?
Yeah, well, that he is Robert Taylor, who's one of the elites that I study and work in, you know, sort of research and write about. Is the grandfather of Valerie Jarrett. So you, in some ways, you know, we have a direct descendant, if you will, of that vision embodied in the Taylor family, Taylor being one of the persons who advocated more social democratic policies out of the 40s and became increasingly, he was part of this trend talking about racial democracy. I mean, the difference here, though, is Robert Taylor believed in public housing. Valerie Jarrett is a real estate developer and was part of a group, Vince Lane and others, to, you know, usher in the devolution and the of public housing, actually the destruction of public housing in Chicago and other places. So, you see more of through the attack on public housing. You see more along the lines of all this discourse on personal responsibility. Class conflict between, middle class folks, black middle class folks, and black working class, and particularly black poor folks. So I think her being sort of the kingmaker with the Obamas, I think, shows that relationship. And she was the one who introduced the Obamas to basically the black elite in Chicago, and they played a huge role in getting him launched, along with others. And so they see certainly him fulfilling that agenda that I think was created, right after the war. They see him as instituting, racial democracy and more.
Well, I wish somebody would give the lecture on personal responsibility to Robert Rubin, but I don't think that's forthcoming anytime soon.
No, I don't think so either.
All right. Thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Preston Smith, who teaches at Mount Holyoke College. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Anthony DaCosta about India. Thank you. And that's some of the first movement of Schubert's Piano Sonata number 12, performed by Anders Schiff. And, well, the horrendous massacre in Mumbai last week brought India to the front pages of all the world's newspapers and onto the world's TV screens. I thought it would be a good time to look at the political economy of that country, always described as the world's largest democracy and one of the great cliches of journalism. What's going on? What helped produce that? And what's been going on in the broader Indian economy in the last 20 or so years, the neoliberal era? To answer some of those questions, I turn to Anthony DaCosta, who is a professor of Indian studies at the Copenhagen Business School in Denmark. Anthony DaCosta. Welcome, Anthony. First of all, do you buy the official explanation that the Pakistanis were behind the events in Mumbai?
Well, that's obviously a very interesting and a fairly open-ended question, in the sense that for India, and perhaps one might even say for Pakistan, the external enemy has always been the scapegoat. Now, it's often undefined, but everybody knows who they mean when they say external hands. That's basically the phrase that's often used. And, of course, in the Indian case, it appears that, you know, Pakistan was somehow involved. Now, I have to say, though, we, of course, know, even when I was living in the U.S., of course, the CIA and everybody used to say that, you know, the ISI, which is the sort of intelligence agency of Pakistan, they obviously had a certain kind of a role in dealing with certain types of groups within Pakistan. Now, obviously, what the purposes of that were, varied from one sort of motive to another. But in the Indian case, oftentimes, the Indian authorities often suggested that the ISI was also responsible for events that took place, you know, previously. Now, in this case, they have not mentioned ISI as far as I can tell, but they have obviously pointed the finger at Pakistan. Now, pointing the finger at Pakistan may mean two things. One, that there is an official sort of support for such groups, perhaps indirectly. Or on the other hand, these are Pakistani nationals, but over which the Pakistani government has no control. In fact, I have a feeling that it is the latter, that there are such groups, and perhaps the Pakistan government is aware of them, but basically cannot control them. They have obviously formulated their own sort of purposes and motivations to do some whatever kind of damage or whatever kind of public relations kind of tactics that they have for their own ends. And so that might be the thing. So the thing is that when you ask me the question, do I buy the Indian official story about Pakistan? I mean, I obviously, you know, have no, you know, rigorous evidence to suggest anyway in any direction. But I do think that there is some Pakistan element involved in all of this. And the reason for it is simply the fact that now, of course, we don't know. They did capture one of the terrorists. So the question is, you know, what comes out of in terms of the actual truth in terms of who was involved and what kind of support they were getting is obviously very difficult for me to say. And, of course, what the officials will reveal at that point. But I have a feeling that there is a connection. There's definitely a connection in all of this.
Tariq Ali had a piece recently in which he argued that the Indian government would like to blame Pakistanis because they don't want to admit the degree of discontent among the domestic Muslim population. What do you think of that?
I think there is definitely a merit to that sort of an argument. But I get the sense that, you know, from my own sort of dealings with, you know, colleagues who are also Muslims by background, is that there is obviously, in fact, the Indian government itself put out a report quite recently, in fact, probably last year or year before last year, about basically, you know, what is the condition of Indian Muslims. And it paints a very sort of sorry picture in the sense that in terms of, you know, jobs and employment and, you know, their income levels and social status and so on. So there is obviously a society-wide knowledge in that sense and coming from the Indian government that the Indian minorities, that is Muslims in this case, they have not been doing very well. And I think especially the issue becomes very relevant in part because, you know, there are other social groups which have benefited considerably, you know, with this global economic integration as far as India is concerned. So that's true. That is true in the sense that there is a certain kind of marginalization going on in India, which also affects the Indian Muslims, especially the lower income group Muslims, particularly found in smaller towns and in rural areas. So that's true. But one would also have to add that there are other Indian minorities especially, you know, low-income groups of who knows what kind of social backgrounds, but certainly lower caste people who also have not been benefiting. So I think in some ways, yes, there is a kernel of truth to that there is a marginalization process taking place. But I think it's, you know, hitting a number of different social groups at the same time. So I think Tariq Ali, in that sense, is partially correct.
Now, this is an immensely complex question for a brief radio interview, but let me try it anyway. I don't want to come off as some kind of Marxist fundamentalist about class issues, but there is some sense in which the ethnic and religious tensions of a society as complex as India are playing out a class conflict as well as an ethnic and religious conflict. How do these things relate? What are the material divisions between, say, Muslims and Hindus in India? Does that map out to class in any kind of convenient way?
No, I don't think there is an easy way to sort of look at this in a purely sort of class-defined sort of way. But I would have to say that class is playing a role in the sense that if one were to look at, say, the upper caste Hindus, although there are middle caste Hindus who have also sort of gained from, say, economic integration and globalization, there are also an elite Muslims as well in India. So they are very much part of the what we would call the Indian bourgeoisie or the Indian middle class. They have certainly benefited. So in that sense, of course, you know, it would be hard to find evidence where the elite Muslims have not benefited. I think that would be I could make that case. But if you take a simple sort of divided society, a Hindu society and a Muslim society, one would, of course, probably make the argument, proportionally that is, that the Muslim minorities in the lower income groups obviously have not done as well as the lower income groups as the Hindus have done. This, I think, we can establish. And I think this is where the class division shows up. But I don't think that Indian Muslims as a group have particular sort of sympathies for fundamentalist groups in India or outside of India. There are sympathizers, there's no doubt about it. But where exactly lies the sympathy and to what degree is very, very difficult to say, because Muslims in India themselves are actually quite fragmented. Because again, very much one has to bring in the regional dimension in India. So Muslims in West Bengal and in Bihar and in Uttar Pradesh would be quite different from, let's say, Muslims living in Gujarat, or for that matter, in Maharashtra, where Mumbai being the capital city. So I think there are a lot of those regional differences as well. So ethnicity is probably a better way of defining it, but it doesn't sort of neatly fall into class categories.
This is almost certainly likely to strengthen the hand of the Hindu right, the BJP. What do you expect from them, and what is the root of their support?
Well, the root of their support, of course, is that, first of all, the Hindu right, at least until a couple of years ago, or I should say about 4 years ago, when they formed the government, one thing one has to sort of say that they are quite well organized, or at least until then they were very, very well organized. They have an ideological wing, they have a political party, and then they have all these other sort of support group systems, including the youth group and so on. So in some ways, they are very, very well organized, very cadre-based. That's another thing. Now, what that may mean, of course, is that they may regroup in such a way to, you know, use this as a way for their campaign for the upcoming elections. But I think last time we remembered that when the BJP government was thrown out, they were thrown out despite the fact that they tried to, talk about India shining, that is, India was doing very well in the global economy and so on. But I think in the end, it wasn't the religious divide or their right-wing fundamentalism that upset the people. It was essentially that the, you know, economic benefits were not benefiting, you know, lots of people in the rural and small town areas and the other various sort of social groups, the marginalized groups. So that was what led to their defeat in the elections. So this time, it's kind of hard to say whether they could capitalize on this and use this as a way to mobilize the public to have them elect them to offices. I think that might be a little difficult, because I think the public has learned in the end that religion by itself doesn't get you, you know, bread on your table. I think that's basically what's going on. So I do have a feeling that they'll have a tough time in using this, but they will still use it, because it is a kind of, you know, a strategy that they will have to play against the Congress Party, saying that, well, you know, you guys have been very soft on terrorism, and therefore we'll do something different and better. And I think that's what they will do.
I'm speaking with Anthony DaCosta, who's a professor of Indian Studies at the Copenhagen Business School. So let's talk a bit about the economy. At least until this recent financial crisis hit, the story was that India was doing very well, booming. You mentioned India shining. How much truth is that to their picture?
You know, I have been one of those persons, you know, who has always been sort of critical about this India shining, in the sense that I suppose India is shining when you look only, you know, a certain segment of Indian society, or if you see certain sectors, industrial and economic sectors, yes, I think you can identify some very good sort of sectors performing. But now it's quite clear that even those shining sectors are not doing very well. In fact, I just printed out an International Herald Tribune article on how the tech boom is slowing down in India because of this current financial crisis. So I think in many ways then the tech boom, so to speak, that existed in India is going to slow down. And I think the reasons are very clear, and at least it has been clear to me for a long time, is that any sector that depends so heavily on the global economy, and the global economy itself is very, very sort of, you know, unstable for whatever reason, and of course we know the reasons for this time why it's unstable, then it's bound to happen that, you know, your exports are going to suffer. We're going to see it in India, and we're going to see it in China as well. Probably China will face a bigger sort of shock, I think, because of their very, very high trade ratio, you know, probably 65 or some percent, whereas India's is something like 28%. So in some ways, India is probably better insulated. So in some ways, what India has missed out in the benefits of economic integration, it may be able to save what it has, whereas China, it might lose actually what it might have gained through economic integration. So I think that the economic scenario right now in India doesn't look good. Any sector that is export dependent is going to get hurt. And certainly the tech boom is going to be one that is going to face a lot of problems, in part because it is so heavily export dependent. Of course, there are other sectors which are not as export dependent, but the financial crisis being what it is, if it leads to credit squeeze and so on and so forth, then of course it's going to hit the other sectors as well.
Of course, much of the Indian population are rural peasants who till the land. How have they experienced any of this boom at all?
Well, I would say that they have experienced some of this boom, especially because one might sort of look at it in the form of, say, remittance income from urban to rural areas. So as, you know, urban jobs increased and there were rural people or people of rural origin working in these urban sectors, they would basically send back money to their family. So there would have been some benefit of this. And, of course, in the Indian countryside, you also have, you know, what are known as bullock capitalists, which means essentially that, you know, they have a pair of bullocks, they own some of their own land, and basically they use their land for profit. In other words, they try to maximize the output of the land and then basically sell the produce in the market. So India has a large number of these sort of middle class, small, tiny, you know, farming households. And they have benefited, partly because the government itself has been supporting the rural industry, rural sector, but the rural sector only in terms of those who own land, because it has been giving, in fact, it's a huge drain on the public treasury in terms of subsidies given for fertilizers. Well, typically it's the larger and the middle landowners who take advantage of the subsidies that are given. So in that sense, the government has propped up a group of farmers in the countryside. And in fact, you have what I would call an embourgeoisment process even in the countryside, which then allows their own sort of economic standing and economic wealth to expand, which then they make small investments in rural areas and perhaps even in the urban areas. So in that sense, yes, you're right that most of the peasants have not benefited from this globalization, a certain part of this. So there has been some trickling down effect into the countryside as well, but again, in a very, very limited way.
And we hear some stories, especially in the Western left press, about suicides in among farmers because they're squeezed by neoliberalism and debt. How significant a factor is that?
Well, there are suicides, definitely, and it's been documented by local as well as the international press quite frequently. Of course, the thing is that rural conditions are pretty miserable in India. And, of course, if you're in debt and for whatever reason, and the debts could arise for all kinds of reasons, you know, it's just that you have a crop failure and that's it. Pretty much that sort of, makes it very, very difficult for a poor family to afford anything, because you rely on the income from the land on an annual sort of basis. And so I think that the suicide rates, I think in the larger scheme of things, the number of suicides are probably small. But they are something that that when reported become very, very significant and important. And especially I think in some states, they have been more common. I think I'm thinking of Andhra Pradesh in the south, where I think there has been a lot of suicide deaths in the farming areas. This is also an area where, you know, various sort of Marxist Naxalite groups have been active. It is also a state where there has been the rise of the information sector. So there are a number of interesting things going on in the same state while there are also these sort of rural sort of misery. And I think that this sort of suicides will impact the public perception about where the country is going. Of course, it all depends on if they become very frequent, then the government will have to do something. And I think the government has noticed that, you know, this is a significant issue, and especially when it gets reported every day in the domestic as well as in the foreign presses, it will become an issue. So I would say that, yes, the government ought to be doing something about this, and it is a serious enough issue that obviously the situation in the countryside is pretty lousy.
Now, the standard story you get in the Western business press is that India was a very tightly regulated economy that was suffering under stagnation and state control until roughly the early 1990s, when a neoliberal regime came in and deregulated everything and unleashed a great boom. How much truth is there to that standard story?
There is obviously definitely quite a bit of truth to that, in the sense that what was previously regulated, and I'm thinking mainly in terms of, let's say, foreign trade, in terms of investments, and then, of course, in certain sort of policy matters where there has been a fair amount of deregulation. Deregulation in the sense that what was controlled either in terms of the quantity of investment or in the quantity of annual output, those things have been deregulated. But that's on paper. You know, paper in the sense that if you pick up a government document where it states its policies, it will say that, you know, we allow free investment in all of these sectors except one or two. And I think the one or two is arms and ammunition and nuclear energy and a few other things. One or two small things, which in any case, most private businesses, generally speaking, do not enter, at least from a business point of view. But in reality, something different. The reality being, this is the federal government, or in India, you would say the central government, making these sort of deregulatory kinds of decisions. But in the end, the investment always has to take place in a particular location, and that location will be in one or another state. So the state government then comes into play and obviously determines, you know, how to manage this investment or how to facilitate the investment and so on and so forth. And that's where I think a lot of the problems arise. So from the outside, then you will find that, or from even from the inside, you will find that people will argue that, well, yeah, we are deregulated, but, you know, it's extremely difficult to do business. And I think that's because the capacity of these local governments is such that they haven't geared themselves up to absorb lots of investments. And what is interesting, of course, in a neoliberal setting where there is deregulation going on, there is simultaneously, there is a rise in corruption as well, because the economic opportunities also increase for particular people in particular places, especially I'm thinking about the politicians. Because there's lots of money to be made when you grant a license to serve, let's say, the telephone industry, let's say. There's lots of money to be made. So who gets the license is an interesting question. And how is it determined? True, there are bids and all of those kinds of things. But in the end, somebody is being paid off or somebody is being made to pay off somebody else. So there's a lot of money-making opportunities at the same time. For all of these reasons, some businesses find it extremely difficult to operate. Not that they are not aware of corruption elsewhere, but it's just that it makes the Indian deregulatory sort of framework somewhat difficult to fathom, especially at the local levels. So in that sense, yes, I think there is a lot of deregulation on the one hand, and that is, you know, evident by the fact that there are many more multinational companies that are operating today. Indian businesses themselves have been expanding their capacity. So from that point of view, yes, there is a lot of deregulation. But there are many other areas where it is still fuzzy, I think. I think they haven't been able to figure out a lot of things. And partly because I think it is the it's partly the administrative capacity, but definitely there's a lot of political sort of issues or political vested interests that prevent such reforms.
Now, what about the longer-term prospects for India? I mean, if there's the financial crisis to worry about, certainly the Mumbai events are not good for India's image and might scare away some foreign capital. There was also some unfavorable comparisons with China because the Chinese infrastructure is much more modern than India's infrastructure. What do you see as the long-term economic prospects for India?
For India, I think what I can see is that this sort of first set of reforms, or maybe 2-3 rounds of the first set of reforms that has taken place thus far, is probably, it's for a while, I think it's going to be that way. And in other words, it has reached its peak. And I don't think that further reforms will come very, very easily. Number one, I think they've reformed whatever could be reformed. And the rest are essentially, you know, there are all kinds of bottlenecks, political and otherwise. There are all kinds of bottlenecks through which they can get through. That's one thing. But on the other hand, if the growth rate is to be maintained, then obviously certain other things have to also change. But here is the problem. We have high growth rates, or we've had high growth rates, and we've also sort of created a fairly large class of consumers in India. But we also know that there are large numbers of Indians who basically have not partaken of this sort of growth. So this, I think, becomes a real challenge because, to me, the problem is really domestic demand. In other words, how to create the domestic demand, which basically calls for redistributive types of policies, slowing down growth in some areas and pushing for growth in other areas, but in a way that allows the local people to, you know, have jobs and incomes and so on. I think this, I think, is the central sort of problem as far as the Indian economy is going. So until and unless it addresses this particular issue, I don't think that it's going to go very, very far because it's a cliched term, you know, but India is very, very messy. You have read about, I'm sure, the Tata's, Nano production had to be moved somewhere else from the state of West Bengal because of local political, skirmishes that they had. And so, I mean, that was supposed to be, that's almost like a global project, and yet it had to be moved. Not because of the state government, which is, interestingly enough, a Marxist government in the state of West Bengal, but because of opposition. So every state has their own sort of factionalism. And in many ways, I think India is obviously quite different from China in the sense that India is a very, very politicized society. I think in some ways, we've had scholars talking about an overdeveloped state. Well, I think in India is basically it's an overdeveloped political system where people are able to make certain kinds of political demands and negotiate things politically, as a result of which you can't do the things that you want to do to, let's say, to have high economic growth rates or, for that matter, to have a nice redistributive balance sort of growth-based system. I think it's going to be very, very difficult. So from that point of view, I don't think that India is going to be shining further. I don't think so. I think there are limits to what India can do.
And that was Anthony DaCosta, who's a professor of Indian Studies at the Asia Research Center at the Copenhagen Business School in Denmark. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. And let's go out with this, a little bit of Yvonne from Rhythm King and Her Friends. German lesbian electropop, gotta love it. Till next week, bye.
There is so much in the desert for you. We understand that you just want to soar, but instead you have to painstakingly build the plane in the sky too. Some people will say that yours is not a convincing sky, and this may cast doubt in your mind and in the mind of your plane. You and your plane may look up and then look heavenward and then at each other and say, we thought it looked real. We thought the Nimbus clouds